This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on September 12, 2013. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, September 12, 2013 will now come to order. We have four commissioners at the table, and Commissioner Walther is joining us by phone. I apologize for the delay for those who came to watch the proceedings, and anybody who happens to be listening online. We had some late submitted documents, and of course we wanted to wait until we could establish contact with Commissioner Walther. So we will begin with the first item of the agenda, which is correction and approval of the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before I make the motion, I have a parliamentary inquiry, if I could. I see item 5, enforcement manual, says to be held over to a future meeting. Could I ask about that? Who's holding?
I suppose you are asking about that. I am holding with the support of Commissioner Walther.
Okay.
As you know, because he sent around an email.
Well, his email didn't say who was holding. Correct.
Said he was supporting the hold.
Right. But the hold was in the passive voice. The email did not say who was holding. Correct.
Right. The email said that he was supporting the hold. Yes, and I am holding as well. Yes.
Okay. If I could take a point of personal privilege on that. Thank you.
Feel free.
The enforcement manual has taken on this issue has taken on a life of its own, and I think in many ways that's a good thing, because it represents and symbolizes two entirely different worldviews on how the FEC ought to function. But what is clear to me is that this is not going to be considered while I'm still a commissioner. It's clear that there's this. I've heard, well, we need six commissioners. We've heard that there's going to be a Republican power grab with a 3-2 vote. We've heard a lot of excuses, all of which really have been debunked. We all know we don't need six commissioners to conduct business. We also know that we're not going to do some 3-2 vote to jam a manual down people's throats. In fact, I've written two letters to editors of two different newspapers that had blatantly false editorials on the point. Where, because in my view the manual goes to what the statute means, it takes four votes to adopt, and that could not be clearer under the Act, that the Commission construes the Act, and when it construes the Act, it takes four votes. It's unfortunate that it's turned into this, and I guess I take it as a weird backhanded compliment that I don't get to be involved, and somehow having me involved is that threatening. What's frustrating, though, is that the longer this goes, the more questions get raised, and the worse it looks. And for anyone to say with a straight face that we have a functioning process now is absurd. The fact is we don't. Just this week we had a case. We've closed it out, but it's not public yet, so I'm not going to identify the respondent. But we had a case where... And when the public sees it, you'll be able to, well, maybe not be able to see it because some of this doesn't, for whatever reason, go public. But a case where a complaint came in and OGC sent a letter to the respondent asking for factual information. We're not talking about reading a newspaper and sending a newspaper for comment. We are, in my view, propounding discovery. We're talking about propounding discovery before a reason to believe vote, which, under the Act, is not permitted, and then the case even gets more bizarre, where once the factual information came in, the vendor that was identified as having conducted a service for the person who was actually named in the complaint was sent a letter saying that a complaint had been filed against them, indicating that they had violated federal law. Well, that no complaint had been filed against this against this third-party vendor. They were merely a vendor for a campaign. It is not a good feeling to receive a letter from the federal government saying you violated federal law and there's a complaint, or you may have violated federal law due to a complaint when there is no complaint against you. The problem with all this is that there is no process that I know of that gets to the heart of this. And what I've been trying to do since I've been here is open this up and get processes in place. And what goes on pre-RTB is one of the areas that, well, there have been quite a lot of, there's been quite a bit of discussion in various MERS, and I've tried to have this discussion so the public can be a part of it. And unfortunately, that's not going to happen. There's not much I can do about it. It's the way it is, I suppose. But the more the truth comes out on what's been happening, the worse it's going to look. And then there's the other issue with reaching out before reason to believe with the Internal Revenue Service. Still don't have good answers on that one. Questions continue to mount. Just today, there's another news clip that talks about emails from the Hill, I guess, is released from the IRS. And again, it's tough to piece this together because, you know, MERS are confidential, and until they go public, you don't really get to see the timing of how things are moving and whether they're moving quickly and slowly and how this stuff impacts current MERS. And I really can't get into current MERS, but eventually this is going to, what I've been saying is going to come out. It's going to come out piecemeal, and it's not going to look good. And this news clip that I'm talking about says, and I'm going to read it, the emails also put the targeting in the context of the media and congressional drumbeat over the impact of conservative campaign spending on the 2012 elections. On July 12, 2012, then Lerner advisor, that's referenced to Lois Lerner, advisor Sharon Light emailed Ms. Lerner a national public radio story on how outside money was making it hard for Democrats to hold their Senate majority. The Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee had complained to the Federal Election Commission that conservative groups like Crossroads GPS and Americans for Prosperity should be treated as political committees rather than 501c4s, which are tax-exempt social welfare groups that do not have to disclose their donors. Quote, perhaps the FEC will save the day, unquote, Ms. Lerner wrote back later that morning. That response suggests Ms. Lerner's political leanings, and it also raises questions about Ms. Lerner's intentions in a separate email exchange she had when an FEC investigator inquired about the status of the conservative group, the American Future Fund. The FEC and the IRS don't have the authority to share that information under Section 6 of 6103 of the Internal Revenue Code, but the bigger question is why did they want to? After the FEC inquiry, the American Future Fund also got a questionnaire from the IRS. These are the kind of questions that if we had a written procedure in place, we wouldn't even really have to ask because this sort of thing wouldn't have happened. But now that these things are happening and it's in the public, it really is incumbent upon the commission to act sooner rather than later, get to the bottom of this. And really, the enforcement manual is the perfect vehicle to discuss this. Not to discuss it and cast aspersions, but to figure out what happened and see what sort of process we need in place so that this sort of thing can't be questioned. If there's a proper way to do things pre-RTB, I think me and my colleagues are all ears. That's just not the way we read the statute. But regardless, there's just no procedure. Finally, the timing of many of these cases is very troubling to me. We have cases that have been sitting, waiting for OGC reports for up to 2 years. Why? Well, in some of these cases, my guess is they're probably conducting pre-RTB discovery. So this is something that also bogs down the process and slows down MERS. Some of these MERS, this is the second, we're waiting for second reports, meaning the first report was withdrawn because, well, it wasn't that good or there were issues. And I don't want to get into specifics on what responded and what case, but I can talk about these sort of things generally. And the timing of this stuff becomes very troubling. And when you put it all together, it's a very, very bad picture. Eventually, this will all come out. And when it comes out, it's not going to look good. And I want to be on record as saying I am doing everything I can to prevent it, and I am pushing to have this sort of discussion in a public meeting about what the procedures ought to be going forward, because the commission is in sore need of dealing with these sorts of issues. And the public needs to be a part of this. So I've explained to a couple different folks in the media who like to write things about all the evil the Republicans are doing here and how we're stopping the staff from doing things and whatnot. just keep in mind, you wouldn't know any of this but for the fact that we insisted on this being in a public meeting, and we have made documents public and asked to have documents public and put out memos and whatnot discussing all this. It was with the support of the commission that this was put into the public. Years past, the commission would have these discussions behind closed doors. This is a discussion that can't be behind closed doors. I'm ready to have the discussion, but the precedent now is that a commissioner can hold something in perpetuity. That's how it is. And ordinarily, I do not talk when someone gives a hold, but there's also a precedent because we had a hold on this very same issue, in July, and the chair nonetheless made a statement regarding the substance. So I am not breaking new ground here by commenting on something that's being held, but I want to state this for the record, because the longer this goes on, the more the questions mount, the more difficult it gets to explain, and the more I see, the more I don't like it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. As you note, normally when we hold things over, we don't discuss them. You've raised a lot of issues that go to the substance of the matters that we're not discussing, as well as some enforcement matters that haven't been made public yet, so I'm not going to address those. But really, I know that you're taking this very personally, but it's actually not about you. It's about, well, right now it looks like there are two empty seats over here, but we've got somebody on the phone, but it's about that empty chair over there. Could I finish, please, Commissioner Hunter?
Yes. I didn't say a word. I just raised my hand.
Okay. We have, at the moment, three Republicans, one Democrat, one independent, no general counsel. I understand you think that's a great time to be proceeding on considering changes to the operating procedures of the agency. It doesn't seem that way to me. And it's not just me. We've received a lot of comments from public interest groups, from members of the Senate. Seen, you may disagree with the editorials, but there have been a number of editorials that have also said we should wait for the pending nominees to get here, in part because they're the ones who are going to have to live under any new procedures that the commission may or may not choose to adopt. And they deserve a say in that. And they deserve a say in how the agency is going to operate going forward. And I'm happy to hear that you believe the enforcement manual would require four votes, but you have also shown a willingness to use the fact that there are three of you on that side of the table and fewer on our side of the table to raise procedural motions and to at least threaten to try and control the terms of the debate on a three-vote majority. And I will say to you that I have been at the commission when there have been five commissioners in the past, and there were three on my side of the table and two on the other side of the table. And never once in those times, never once, not in private, not in public, not even when the three of us were just sitting around the room by ourselves, never once did any of the people on my side of the table suggest that on a procedural matter, on a substantive matter, on any matter at all that came before this commission, that anything should pass on a so-called three-vote majority. We did not treat our colleagues that way. It raises a big issue for me, so that I need to make sure that as we are discussing major changes to the way the commission has been operating for years, for decades, the commission staff have included publicly available information in their recommendations. There's nothing new or secret about that. And if we're going to consider changes to basic operating procedures of the Office of General Counsel, yes, I think it would be better if we actually had a general counsel. And I regret that we were not able to start this discussion when we still did have a general counsel. But since then, things have changed, and we have nominees pending, and it looks like they're moving relatively rapidly. I believe that this debate is important, and I just want to make sure that when it takes place on a level playing field. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. Another point of personal privilege to respond to some of, just to some of that. It's not that I'm taking it personally. And it's interesting that you characterize it as taking it personally. But what is true is that by insisting on filling the empty chair, it's rather algebraic that that means I'm not involved. So it's hard not to see that it has something to do with that. The notion that new commissioners who are not here should have a say in a manual that has been in a draft form for close to a year strains credulity. Moreover, it's not that they have to live under the manual. It's the people out there, and I point to the audience, who have to live under the manual. The manual is designed to assure objective public processes to protect those who are accused of wrongdoing, to ensure that there's integrity in the process so the public has confidence in what the commission does, to ensure that there's not ad hoc processes that expose the commission to potential accusations of targeting or partisanship. It's not that the new folks have to live under the manual. Quite to the contrary, they have to abide by the manual. It's not for the benefit of the commissioners. It doesn't make the commissioners feel good. It makes the public feel good. So let's get straight on who's the dog and who's the tail in this equation. We work for the people. They don't work for us. And I'm here as a public servant. I'm not elected. I'm appointed by the president. I'm confirmed by the Senate. I have an honorable in front of my title. But that's nothing compared to the people. I work for them. So it's not about me. It's about doing the right thing. And my point is the people are not being served well today, and they have not been served well for quite some time because this discussion has not been had. And we can't even begin the discussion. Maybe it gets picked up down the road. But look, when you take one of these jobs in Washington, D.C., your mail is labeled occupant. It's not really your name on the letterhead. This chair is not my chair. This chair was the same chair that Dave Mason sat in. It was the same chair that Tom Josefiak sat in. It was the same chair that Trevor Potter sat in. It's none of our chairs. It's just one seat on the Federal Election Commission. And it doesn't really matter who sits here, because there should be a larger goal of ensuring that the public has confidence in the processes and that there's some objectivity on what goes on here. Now, what are those processes? You've referenced changing the process, major changes to the process. The fact is there is no process. To claim that there is some sort of process, and it's a long-standing process that's been in place for years, is provably false. That is not the case. There are just too many examples that show that to be the case. And in fact, this has been a recent surge in some of the things that OGC has been doing. This is not old stuff. Talking directly about use of newspaper articles. They were never used for their truth if they were not included in the complaint. They were used for background information. The old 1997 version of the OGC manual talks about using such public information for background material, not for its truth. It's hearsay. But yet now it gets included in OGC reports and larded into the complaint. And if it's part of the complaint, it's not part of the complaint. That's new. And I've been doing this much too long to know what's new and what's not new. And it's just not true to say that somehow what the commission's been doing for years has been uninterrupted for years. It's not. You yourself told the chairman of the House Administration Committee that the old manual was never really a manual. It was a collection of stuff put together. Not even all commissioners didn't even have full copies, apparently. So you yourself have already said the old manual is no manual at all. But now you sit here and say, oh, there's longstanding procedures. Where are they? Just this week we had a discussion about how we name respondents in cases. Now, there was a case, Ralph Nader went to court against the FEC recently, and we were chastised by the federal court that we didn't properly serve all the respondents, and under the statute they had an opportunity to be heard. And so far the commission has done nothing to address that. Are we doing it correctly? Who knows? And when it comes to the commissioners, I can't recall too many commissioners other than me asking questions about this. Now, apparently there's a procedure that is used to do this and generate, but that's not public. Still, not public. We also learned from the counsel's office that this manual that they've drafted isn't the final word. There may be other policies. They want to reserve judgment on. There may be other policies they haven't found that they may want to use somewhere else. When are we going to learn that's not acceptable? This isn't personally about me, but I take it very personally because it's just wrong to do this. You can't have a federal agency that makes it up as it goes along. You can't have ad hoc procedures. Because then respondents think it's who the respondent is. Respondents take it personally. I see cases where there's quite a bit of material sent 6 months after the initial response comes in to certain respondents, but not all respondents. How can that be? Sometimes it's newspaper articles. Sometimes it's just the articles that are inculpatory, not the exculpatory articles. How can that be? Sometimes they ask for factual information prior to reason to believe. How can that be? The major change, I suggest, is doing all this pre-reason to believe. And this is a recent phenomenon. The commissioners have had no input in this. At least the Republican commissioners have had no input on this. We're here. We're commissioners. We're not the 13th floor of a hotel. This weird zone where we exist, but we don't. This discussion needs to happen, and it needs to happen sooner rather than later. Now, your reference to using a 3-2. I need to respond to that. It's odd coming from a commissioner who attempted to have meetings when the commission lacked a quorum to say somehow I'm doing something funny and unprecedented. There were two commissioners for 6 months in 2008. You considered advisory opinions and actually wrote opinions. You wrote the Speech Now opinion. It went 1-to-1. Commissioner Mason said there would not be contribution limits. You said there would be. D.C. Circuit sided with Commissioner Mason on that. There are other advisory opinions. It was bizarre. And now you're going to sit here and say, gee, everything has to be done regular order. We need six commissioners. And it's never happened before where commissioners have done things in smaller groups. You were part of the smaller group. People were hired when there was no quorum. GS-15s, which under commission directives requires commission approval. How did that happen? It did. So it seems like when the shoe's on one foot, it's okay, but when it's on the other foot, it's not okay. Now, to address directly the 3-2, it is true that I did say majority covers. My view is it does on procedural issues, and it's on my view. Office of General Counsel agreed, the directives say so. And the reason why it probably never came up before is there was never a situation where a chair was attempting to cut off the other side in debate. And that's what happened, and I didn't like it. You tried to cut me off in discussing a MER, in deliberating a MER, and I understand you don't like you've grown very weary of me sitting here and talking all the time. Many people have. Not everyone has. But we were left with no choice because when one side tries to cut the other side off on deliberating, the only protection we have is the procedural rules. And remarkably, once I said the procedural rules will be used to avoid one side being silenced, you never did it again, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. I made the point, and things have proceeded much smoother since then, because each commissioner matters. Look, the FEC is not like other agencies. It's not like the FCC or the SEC with an odd number. There's not a chair especially appointed by the president. Chair doesn't get to pick the council or anything of the sort. We are six, currently five, co-equal Knights of the Round Table. When you have a title, and I've had the title chairman, I'm now a title vice chairman, you have a lot more homework to do. You have to worry about managing the agency and moving things along. But at the end of the day, when it comes to votes, it still requires a vote of the commission, and it still requires that the statute be adhered to. So this idea that somehow there's been some partisan power grab behind the scenes is unprecedented, again, I take issue with and I think is false. I think it was a reaction to overreach on your part. Fortunately, I thought we had put that behind us, and things have moved much better once we had an understanding that we all get to share our views. But I can't let you just throw this out and say, well, you know, somehow we've been concocting something, and somehow nobody's ever thought of this before, and that sort of thing. just looking at the directives, that's obviously not true, because the directives do talk about when you can do majority rule. The statute itself is majority rule, except for certain enumerated things, like voting reason to believe, issuing depositions, subpoenas, finding probable cause, initiating lawsuits, that sort of thing. So even the statute talks about majority rule, but we're not going to do majority rule on the enforcement manual. That was a much, much ballyhooed rumor that seemed to be foisted on us by reform groups and editorial boards. It's not true. I've already written publicly on that. That excuse is now off the table. So it is what it is. I understand it's not going to be considered, that it's going to be held in perpetuity. Until so-called new commissioners show up, because somehow we owe it to them. And maybe there's probably some merit to that. I mean, it would have been nice if when I was appointed and I came in, I had a say in some things that had happened in late 2007. It would have been nice if I had a say in some things that happened in early 2008. It would have been nice if I had a say in maybe some budgetary issues, but I didn't, and because I wasn't a commissioner until I was a commissioner. But I don't sit here and say, gee, you know, I wasn't here, so I should have had input in something that happened before I got here. That's not how you play the game. But maybe it is how we play the game now.
Well, just a moment. I will recognize you in a moment, Commissioner Hunter. I just want to respond to just a couple of the points that my colleague made. We have now spent a very long time talking about something that, according to the agenda, we weren't going to talk about, but that's okay. I understand my colleague has been frustrated and wanted to get a few things out there. There are many, many things that you just said that I disagree with. I'm not going to go through them one by one, but there are two things that I am going to respond to. At the end of 2007, the commission unanimously rewrote the directives to try and figure out exactly what could two commissioners do, as we foresaw that situation coming upon us, in order to keep the lights on and keep the agency operational. And obviously, we could not issue advisory opinions, but we felt that under the statute, the commission is supposed to meet. So the two of us that were here, we met. And neither one of us, neither Commissioner Mason nor I, were under any delusion that we could issue an advisory opinion. However, we thought if people were submitting an advisory opinion, the least we could do was to tell them what our views were. And in no matter whether we agreed or disagreed, we knew that the requesters were still going to get the same answer, and that was going to be, for lack of four votes, you don't get an advisory opinion, because there weren't four votes to be had. And everyone understood that. We just thought, to the extent it's useful to folks, there's, you know, here's two commissioners. This is what we think on these issues. I really somewhat regret having to go through this, because I know this is going to just generate another comment. But I never cut you off. You had held the floor for half an hour, grilling the staff quite intensely, and another commissioner raised his hand during a pause in the questioning after you had received an answer, and I called on him. And you said, I wasn't finished yet. And when I said, well, Commissioner Walther raised his hand, and now it's his turn, you walked out of the room rather than give another commissioner a chance to say anything at all before we would return to you. And that is what happened. And then when we came back after lunch, we had an hour and a half long debate about whether the chair gets to control time at the table, whether once a commissioner is called on, he gets to monopolize discussion all day long. I thought that was rather a waste of time, but you made your point that you were prepared to, you know, take steps that I had never seen taken before. And I have taken that lesson to heart, and I have been guided by the notion that it could happen again at any time. And that is one of the things that I bear in mind. This notion of the three-vote majority and the notion that perhaps an enforcement manual could be adopted on fewer than four votes is not one that was raised on our side of the table. But it did get out into the public arena, and it's been debated, and there are people on listservs and other places that have now said, yeah, we think they could do it with three votes. For all I know, a judge might take that point of view. And I, as I said, need to ensure that when this discussion takes place and if any votes are held, that it's done on a level playing field to make sure that the four-vote rule really does pertain, and any procedures for this agency are only adopted on a bipartisan vote. Commissioner Hunter, you wanted to say something. It appears that she is. I wanted you to know I haven't forgotten that you wish to speak, Commissioner Hunter. But if you wish to defer to the Vice Chairman, by all means.
I'll leave it that we have a slightly different recollection on what transpired. But it sounds like we agree. I did make a point that had an effect, and it's a shame that it had to get to that to make the point. Just two things on the lack of quorum. The first part of 2008, the act says a quorum requires four commissioners. You can rewrite the directives unanimously all you want. Quorum says four, it means four. The fact is, you had meetings, votes were cast. There's certs, vote certs. You voted without a quorum. The NLRB tried the same thing. It went to court. The U.S. Supreme Court said, nice try. You can't operate without a quorum. Statute means what it says. On the 3-2 for an enforcement manual, whether or not a judge would accept it, who knows, but I'm glad that you invoked that, because there is a question of how one gets judicial review of such things, and the fact that you are musing as to whether a judge would accept a 3-2 must mean, therefore, we do have agreement that the commission must at least vote on the manual, and with a vote that would at least give somebody potentially somehow a way to take judicial review of what we're doing in our procedures. I've seen this trick here before where staff sort of has their own procedures, and I've never seen a way to get judicial review of such things. But I'm glad to see that we at least agree that the commission has to vote, because that's the only way the public can really, if they want to, seek the appropriate review in front of an Article III judge.
You may be over interpreting what I said, Commissioner, but Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to associate myself with the comments of the Vice Chair. This has been a long, ongoing discussion on how we're going to consider the enforcement manual. As I mentioned last time, it all started at the House Oversight hearing in November 3rd of 2011. And I believe now, that we should have a public enforcement manual that's voted on by the Commission. That, as the Vice Chair suggested, the idea that we just have a part of the manual public and there's other things that are kept secret within this building is completely unacceptable. I'm not prepared to go back before the House Administration Committee and tell them that, sorry, we couldn't get four votes on it, or we don't think it's the kind of thing that needs the vote of the Commission. It's the Commission's enforcement manual. We've tried to be very respectful of certain things that the Office of General Counsel wants to do within their sort of parameter that they're given under the statute. And we describe it, used a light pen in those areas. But there are numerous issues that we now can't even discuss, which I think is completely unacceptable. We are sitting commissioners right now. We do care about what the new commissioners think when they get here. But they're not here yet, and we should at a minimum be able to discuss these issues. We have said that we're not going to jam this down 3-2 vote on this issue because we think it's important enough that it needs four votes. I agree that we probably could have done that, and a lot of those memos, first of all, relying on the statute, and second of all, relying on some of the very same memos that you cited that were used when there were only two commissioners. The Office of General Counsel said there was a whole bevy of things that we could do with here at this commission with three votes. But we have said we think that this is important enough, and it should be a bipartisan document that we would like to have four votes for it. We have been working with at least one of our colleagues on this. Commissioner Walther at one point was talking with us behind the scenes a little bit, and we appreciate his efforts, you know, back then. He's sort of he's backed off a little bit, and I haven't spoken with the chair on the substance of this issue since it started, which is unfortunate. And again, I think it's outrageous that we haven't discussed this, you know, in a public setting with the sitting commissioners. As I said, there's a number of issues that are going on every day. Respondents have to respond to complaints every day without an enforcement manual. It's completely unacceptable. They don't know what the rules are, and that leads to unfair treatment, in my view. We don't even know what the penalty schedule is. You, Madam Chair, have said since I got here that you thought that the penalty schedule should be public. Well, guess what? We've attached a penalty schedule in our proposal of the enforcement manual. We're willing to vote on that. We're willing to discuss it. We're willing to take any edits you have to it. But we have a clear proposal on what the penalty schedule should be. That's something that we should talk about. The public shouldn't be made to guess any longer on that issue. Another one, in the past couple of weeks, information has come to light about a matter that's now closed, an enforcement case, MER 6234, the CNEC matter. And I've been particularly troubled by some of the information that just came to light that I actually didn't know about, even though I was the chair of this place when these letters were being circulated. The Office of General Counsel sent the file over to the Department of Justice on August 23rd, told them about the case, I should say, on August 23rd, and shortly thereafter sent the entire file over. The case was sent to CRU because they were the complainant in the matter on August 22nd of last year. August 20th of last year, and CRU posted it on their website on August 22nd. So the email went over from the FEC the day after it was posted by CRU on their website, but the Office of General Counsel notifies the Department of Justice that this person, Mr. Cenac, made an unqualified admission of knowing and willful conduct, and this matter has been on his list to direct to your attention since we obtained the deal, which I don't know what date he's talking about, but I have to assume that he means on July 30th, a month before the matter was made public. So it appears as if the intention was to share the matter with the Department of Justice before it was public. The conciliation agreement is publicly available on the FEC website, I believe, but we of course have additional materials we can make available if you're interested in pursuing. So here we have the Office of General Counsel sharing information about a MER without consulting the commission at all, without even telling us that they're planning to do this. And there is no policy governing this conduct. Even in the Office of General Counsel's proposal in the enforcement manual as it stands now, there's nothing that addresses the Office of General Counsel initiating contact with the Department of Justice before a case is made public or after. There is nothing. In the proposal that we have set forward, we have spelled out in great detail, with a lot of careful consideration, a policy that we think adequately addresses the needs of the FEC to enforce the law, which nobody doesn't want to do, but also to protect respondents and to let the public know what the process is. So when they enter into conciliation agreement with the Federal Election Commission, they know what the rules of the road are. That brings up another issue in this case. Recently disclosed letters suggest that in conciliation, we don't have all the information yet, so I can't get into all the details, but suggests that the respondent in this matter was under the impression that the FEC would not share information about this case with the Department of Justice. In a letter written to the FEC on October 9th of 2012, it says, again, as we discussed, Mr. Cenac agreed to resolve this matter through conciliation based in substantial part on the FEC's agreement not to refer this matter to DOJ, USAO for criminal prosecution. Again, I wasn't in the conciliations. I didn't even know about the conciliation agreement and the fact that there was an issue regarding things that were agreed to or maybe not agreed to, but it's something that's very troubling and something that we should talk about in the context of the enforcement manual, and I look forward to doing that soon. We don't know when the new commissioners are going to be coming on board. As you know, Madam Chair, there was another nominee a few years ago that we thought was going to be here, and you even gave your farewell speech, and that person's not even here. So,
but there's no empty seat. There was no empty seat at the time.
But we've told you that we're not going to vote on this in a 3-2 matter. I mean, maybe there's other procedural issues that are more relevant for a 3-2 majority rule, but we've said this is not one of them. We at least want to have the conversation.
Well, it sounds like we are having the conversation. We're having a remarkable amount of conversation on a topic that it says on the agenda was going to be held over. And I'm very disturbed about we don't even have anybody from enforcement in the room because it was not supposed to be discussed today. And you're bringing up details from past cases, and people are not here to address what happened. I will just say that as you actually conceded, the information that was relayed to the Department of Justice was already public on somebody's website. So I'm going to rein this back in. I thought my colleague just wanted to have a few moments to express himself on the process, and I decided that was, you know, appropriate, but it's really kind of gone a little bit far afield. We have a lot of people here who are waiting for answers to questions, and I would like to return to the actual next item on the agenda, which is Draft Advisory Opinion 2013-4. Yes, Commissioner Walther.
I'm not interested in extending the conversation much longer, but I would like to make a couple of very short points, if I may.
Absolutely.
Let's talk briefly about where we have been coming from in terms of the progress that's been made in this agency. This agency has been in existence for over 35 years. When we started in the last, I'd say, 4 years, and I would say certainly Commissioner McGann was supportive of these, the commission has made unprecedented improvements in the transparency and the ability of the public and the respondents to participate in our deliberative process. And I don't think that has been adequately pointed out. The impression that's been given is somehow there's an effort to quietly keep information from the public. Now I think it's important to point out that any of the complaints about that are ones that probably could have been made quite some time ago, before all this arrived. But I would point out we have eliminated materials for the consideration of the enforcement manual. We've improved procedural rules for audit hearings, procedure for notice of respondents of non-complaint-generated matters, for amendments of the agency procedure for probable cause hearings, and the policy regarding placing first order accounts for report in the public record, something new. Guidebook for complaints and response from the FEC enforcement process. That particular document is the first time that we've ever tried to help the public and the respondents to understand what happens when a complaint is filed. A lot of work went into that, and that's been public on the website since 2009. That has been the first time in over 30 years that there's been an actual description of our process, our whole enforcement process for the public. And when I say whole, it went from the very beginning to the very end. Yes, there's more to be added to the extent we want to, but let's just make this clear that this has been an overriding concern of all of us to make this whole process more transparent and more fair. We've had the Directive 68 on the enforcement procedures. We have the Directive 69, which was to legal guidance of the Office of Compliance. We have the FEC Directive in processing audit reports. We've provided hearings available in reference to the Commission for giving opinions midway between the audit process, so we don't have to wait till the very end of the audit process and find out that it's been moving along a legal track that the Commission did not agree with. We've had agency disclosure documents and information on enforcement matters, procedure for doing that. One of the things that I think is very important to point out is that for the first time, we actually adopted a policy to make sure that when we get information provided to us and in the investigative process, it is not at the PRTV stage a prosecutorial issue. It's an investigative fact-finding issue that needs to be objective so that all inculpatory and exculpatory information is made available on a fair and non-advocacy basis for the consideration by the Commission. And I think, despite all that's been said this morning, the people who are involved day in and day out in the enforcement process, and some of the top lawyers in the country are those, will tell you that we've made dramatic improvements over the last 4 or 5 or 6 years in making our process more fair, more deliberative, more objective, and more transparent. So, is there enough to be said? Have we done enough? I would say no. But let me also say that for the last 35 years, what's been called the enforcement manual has been a guidance for internal lawyers in the process. It has to do with a lot of minutia involving how you get things done. I still think that the general counsel should be entitled to have, as a firm or anything else, their own internal guidelines on when you move something from one team to another, or when you begin to bring things out, or how you handle certain matters. And you don't necessarily need to come to the commission for a vote every time an office of general counsel wants to modify his internal procedures on how to make things. At all times, they have to comply with the policies that we have in full force and effect. I would tell you that for the first time since I've been on the commission in the fall, the public has had the opportunity to see what we now would say the enforcement manual that's currently in effect. And Tony Herman immediately passed to our counsel, made public the fact that this is our operative document. There's no question right now of what it is. The question is, I think, whether we agree, whether some people agree with it. I'm aware of two major areas where we are in disagreement, but the ones that have been extant for a long, long time. One is the pre-reasonable area, and the extent to which the Office of General Counsel can look to facts outside the complaint. That is an issue that's been before us, and there's good arguments on both sides. This has been played to make it sound as if there's an effort to quell any ability of the Office of General Counsel to look at any case or any fact outside the process in the pre-IPD stage, even if it might be completely inculpatory. I don't think that's the right procedure, but I think even our Republican colleagues would agree that's not the right way either. So we have, I think, distilled, I would say probably 90% of what you see is probably ones that all of us would agree are satisfactory procedures. There are areas, the way in which we communicate interagency-wide is certainly one that's emerged. And I also feel that, I'm even talking with Mr. Commissioner again, we probably can come pretty close to reaching an agreement on finalizing the policy on that. But sometimes there's a slip between the cup and the lip, but I think we really have made some headway in narrowing that process a lot. So I do think we need a methodology. We've done that and recognized that for some time. And having to have a policy that is more internal guidelines in terms of how we communicate, and not only with the Department of Justice, but how the Office of General Counsel communicates with us as commissioners. I do think we need more reporting and less automatic transmission of documents over there. Let me say one more thing. There has been some public comment about the fact that there would be a real negative impact on our ability to enforce the law. We should limit the way in which we work with the Department of Justice by requiring a subpoena in each instance. To my knowledge, that procedure has been in effect up until a couple of years ago. So it would not be fair to say that just because someone argues that we will not transmit any documents over to the Department of Justice unless there is a procedure, would be trying to impede normal prosecution on either the part of the Department of Justice or us, because that policy has been in effect for a long time. It's been softened, and to the point where I think we need to firm up what those guidelines are going to be going forward. But the own process is one that's been, it's been criticized, but we have been in effect for a long time. I recognize, and I have the same concerns that Mr. Gannon has about trying to change things around here. But I would say, too, that there is a matter that has come before the commission on new facts, right, on new facts in the law. We have still been able to gather the necessary support to get that in place, and that basically is a procedure that allows for a respondent to respond in a formal way to new facts that have been elicited pre-ITB or new legal issues that have arisen that might result in an additional charge or an additional violation. So we all can take a look at ourselves as much as we can look across the table, I think. But we can also look with pride, I think, at what it hasn't done. Now, I don't think it's fair to make comments that are unbalanced in terms of recognizing all of the things that I think our agency's done in the last several years. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner Walther. I misspoke a moment ago when I said the next item on the agenda was Draft Advisory Opinion 2013-04. We still need to approve the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman. Oh, I'm sorry.
Madam
Commissioner
Chair.
Peterson.
Yes, I mean not to. I know that we've all said our piece, and I'd feel left out if I didn't have a chance to say something myself. As Commissioner McGann, as the Vice Chairman McGann pointed out, this whole issue has taken on a life of its own. In that process, it has obscured the fact, as Commissioner Walther just said, that on 90% to 95% of these matters, there's agreement amongst the commissioners, amongst Office of General Counsel, and I think that shouldn't be overlooked. And I think, as Commissioner Walther also pointed out, there have been a number of very positive developments that. That have been spearheaded while we've been here. I give the Vice Chairman a great deal of credit for being at the forefront of most of those, and Commissioner Walters has lended a very important support on those as well. And I think that those have made agency procedures better, more transparent, more fair. I think it's enabled us to make better decisions here as commissioners, and I don't think that should be overlooked either. This really does this. The two issues that obviously have generated all the fireworks on this, the pre-RTB stage and the and commission dealings with Department of Justice, obviously those have been the hot button issues that have gotten all the press, that get all the discussion, and as well they should, because not only are they issues that deal with what the right policy is, what should be, how should we craft a procedure in a way that we think it gets the right result. Fundamentally, they're about the statute. What does the statute permit the commission to do, and what does the statute prohibit the commission from doing? And that is really at the core of that debate, is what does the statute allow the commission to do at the pre-RTB stage? What can be done before there is a vote to find reason to believe to kick off an investigation? Then obviously on the Department of Justice issue, there are two provisions. We talked a little bit back and forth about when is a majority of three, or when is it a minimum of four. The statute is very clear about referring and reporting to the Department of Justice in terms of requiring four, and obviously those two issues have formed the nub of this debate. Just one red herring that needs to be squished underfoot has been the allegation that somehow I or any of my colleagues want to shut down any communication, shut down any relationship, and impede any sort of ongoing communication lines with the Department of Justice. That's, like I said, a complete red herring and a completely false statement. And how that's gotten into the public bloodstream, I think, is very unfortunate. That somehow that anyone is seeking to impede investigations of the Department of Justice, or that that anyone wants from this point forward there to be radio silence between the commission and the department. the concerns, I think, are much more fundamental about what authority the commission has and what jurisdiction we have to make certain referrals and certain materials available to the Department of Justice. And I think that's that's a debate that's been going internally. I think it's one that's been long overdue to be actually for all of the rancor over this issue. We still need to get to this issue to be able to discuss this, because that really gets to the heart of the debate. What authority does the commission have? What does the statute arm us with? And so the sooner that we can get to that debate, I think, in order to resolve those issues, so that we can put into place the, again, 90-95% of the remainder of the enforcement manual that we all agree with, I think it's not only beneficial for us as decision makers and obviously those who work here in the agency, most importantly, it's beneficial for those who have to be subject to our laws and procedures, so that they can know beforehand what are the procedures that the commission is going to apply in the enforcement context. And the sooner that we can do that, I think the better off both everybody inside the building and outside the building will be. Thank you.
Okay, we will now move to the actual agenda. First item is correction and approval of the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If it's in order, I can make two motions for the timely submission of the delayed documents.
Feel free.
Out of the way too. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to adopt agenda document number 13-39, minutes for the open session held on August 22nd, 2013.
Thank you. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of the minutes for the meeting of August 22, 2013, as set forth in agenda document number 13-39. Is there any discussion on the motion? I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries 5-0. You have another motion, Mr. Vice Chairman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to suspend the rules on timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider the late submission of agenda document numbers 13-31-C, revised draft A, 13-38, and 13-40. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of, Vice Chairman has moved that we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider agenda documents number 13-31-C, 13-38, and 13-40. All in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries 5-0. And now, the long-awaited draft advisory opinion 2013-04. I don't know whether anybody's going to have any questions for Mr. Elias. Should I invite him to the table?
I'm
seeing nods. So come on down, Mr. Elias, and Mr. Burkhan as well. I don't mean to slight you, Mr. Burkhan. Does counsel have anything to add? We've seen this before. No. Okay. There is a new agenda document, as the Vice Chairman noted, number 13-31C, which is described as revised draft A. Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask Mr. Elias, give you a little time there to catch up on the latest draft that has circulated around. I'm not suggesting that was an elaborate we need to give you extra time, but just worked out that way. I know it still was probably less than what you would have liked, but I think we all saw this kind of about the same time. Wanted to see what your thoughts were about the language that's currently in here. We've talked a lot back and forth. I've stated what my thought is on this, and I'm curious to see what your thoughts are on the latest draft.
So I think it's
realize.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I think it's close. I think that there are a handful of small wording changes that I think would improve it, mostly making clear that the critical issue is whether under applicable state law it is an alter ego. I'm not sure, we very quickly in the hallway tried to track the provenance of the conciliation agreement in MER 6168. I don't think the conciliation agreement itself actually provides an analysis of alter ego doctrine. I think there's a factual and legal analysis behind it that cites a, what are those, what was it?
Amger.
I was explaining to Mr. Burkon that when I was in law school, Amger was
a book.
Was quite the rage. It was
yes.
A book you'd go and you'd a long time ago.
Longer for me than for you.
So it cites back to an Amger, and I'm not sure that I think this is directionally right, but I think tying it more clearly to that it is not merely an alter ego of the association under state law, that it would be different if under applicable state law it was found, you know, to not have an independent existence. I'm not trying to wordsmith for the commission, but I think that concept would, I don't have obviously a problem citing to closed MERS, but I didn't, as I looked back to that, I'm a little bit concerned that we're going to wind up at some point down the road trying to figure out exactly what the commission's doctrine of alter ego was, whereas I think if you tie it to state law, you know, we'd obviously look to D.C. law since we're a D.C. entity.
Okay. Another thing that along those same lines that I identified would have been on page 5, line 8. Well, let me start with the sentence starts on line 6 saying, moreover, the requester indicates that the association members, the nation's democratic governors, will generally be precluded by law from requesting or suggesting how jobs and opportunities funds are spent. It seemed like that would be another instance where we would need to clarify by stating just by law might indicate that maybe there's a problem with federal law or even our own law, that there would need to be precluded by applicable
state
laws.
Law, right.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a good point.
Vice Chairman?
I don't have much to add. I had the same concern, tie it more to state law, and Mr. Elias, as usual, read my mind. I pulled the conciliation agreement myself, and I agree it doesn't really analyze the law. It talks about national banks, and one's a sub of a parent, and that's a little bit different than this situation. It's kind of the same church, different pew. I don't have any problem citing to the conciliation agreement. It's not a formal law. I wouldn't think one would cite to the law, not to a conciliation agreement. But it does talk about, it does reference 18 Amateur Second Corporations, which was all the rage when we were in law school. There was a second then. You know, it's kind of, I think there's a third now. To the extent that there's support for those minor edits, I think the revised draft A, I think captures what we need to do. I can support it but would like the similar clarification that we're talking about state law. The second concern with just relying on a conciliation agreement is it opens us up to make it look like we're relying on some sort of FEC common law of corporate entities, which I don't think that's the intent. I think the intent was to find a MER where the current commission had agreed to language, because this was from 2009, so there shouldn't be any objection. And I appreciate, I understand the chair may have been the one that found the site, and I appreciate that, and maybe it was Commissioner Walther. I don't want to take it as blame. I'm giving credit to try to find some sort of agreement. But I do agree that we should also, if possible, reference state law. I think, Mr. Elias, in your comments, you did provide a handy site to D.C. law that actually would encompass the whole watershed of D.C. law, whatever it may be, without limitation, citing a case and sort of a see generally and related cases kind of thing. I can certainly support adding that as part of the site to make it clear make the point clear that we discussed last time. So I'm curious to hear whether there could be 4 votes for this revised draft A or not from some of my other colleagues, because I count at least 2, perhaps 3, and it wasn't a revised draft that we put out. So let's see where we are and yield back.
Commissioner Walther, you circulated this draft. Do you wish to say anything?
Yes, I did this. And I said when I did circulate this, I wanted to get comments in an effort to try and see where we can get a little closer. I'm not prepared to necessarily vote for this as it stands, but I wanted to see where the rug still was, if there was any. The issue, of course, is whether we use the word agency or whether we use something else or whether the property bill covers enough to basically pick up the general principle that when this is that a situation where one is really controls the other. And I have various concerns about with the way it currently is for two reasons. And they keep coming back to me when it says the association's members will generally not play a role. Generally, it isn't clear to me how often that would be or what kind of role that would be. And we don't have guidance on that, and it makes me skittish to have that out there where it could be interpreted in a whole different context. But we have thought about it to basically say, you know, one controls the other. And then the other one, of course, is that, with respect to the composition, there is no flexibility in connection with who, if the parties were, it was going to be, that tightens it up to the point where I get concerned that these two votes would have a very little practical leeway to exercise independent judgment. So I try to tie in that concern with the use of here and get related to algorithm, which theoretically is the same concept in a different structure. So I know there is a reticence to use the word agency, as I say, we're looking for the record. And by the way, I wanted to mention that I did talk to Mr. Elias this morning before the hearing. I kind of mostly the criticism of the way we interpreted a couple of things, including this issue about whether or not one aspect of the regulation of the statute either applies to one in the following sense. So I'm trying to figure out a way to make it work, but it's still makes me satisfactorily comfortable that we do not have a situation where one entity is going to de facto control the other, and that the other would not have the independent ability to be independent. So I wanted to get some comment on that. So I think this draft went out late last night, and I want to make sure Mr. Lyons had a chance to look at it and get Kent and your comment on it. I see that the kind of the understanding now is that there should be a broader look at what should be guiding principles in connection with alter ego. Maybe that deserves more attention too. A number of these cases, and like DC law, it doesn't have a lot of alter ego language, that's for sure. So sometimes it may be looking at not FEC common law, but it's certainly coming out or generally applicable either from other states' model laws, law review articles, and maybe looking at our own consideration agreements. So I just want to take a look. Kind of trying to find a way to get that assurance so I could participate with you on this. I'm not quite there yet.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The thing I really like about the draft is that it really does make clear that the Jobs and Opportunity Group is separate and distinct from the DGA. I think the language Commissioner Walters put forth really, really does that. It limits the AO to the facts. There's some language in there that says based upon the facts as represented by the requester. So if the requester moves the goalpost, the AO is not going to apply. So there's a great deal of comfort level there for those who are very concerned that about the amount of separation. I think suggesting including state law makes that line even brighter. It's not intended to water it down. It's actually to further what Commissioner Walther is concerned. I mean, even give more comfort to Commissioner Walther's view. Because AMJURs can get slippery, and if conciliation agreements can get slippery. So my suggestion is to actually make it even more robust on the point. I think it's accurate as to the facts as presented by requester, and in fact, my real reaction to the draft was twofold. First, to the extent anyone is suggesting that the DGA is trying to create some wink and nod shadow soft money group, or the chairman of the DGA is doing something hypocritical, this certainly says that anyone who says that is just full of it. That's utter nonsense. That this is anything other than something that is perfectly above board. So this draft certainly will at least, if nothing else, for the politics of the thing, certainly make clear that this is not some 2Q by half thing that the DGA is trying to do. The flip side of that is the second point, which is if I were these fellows trying to start this group, they really have gotten quite a bit of autonomy here, it really is clear that they are going to be on their own to make the decisions, and to the extent that gives some of my colleagues comfort, that's my intent. I'm reading this AO as really ensuring separation to a degree that I think we've talked about now for two prior meetings. This is the third meeting, and I think I don't know what else to do other than to say yes to this draft with a couple legal cites to make sure that we're citing to the state law that applies. But I think that at this point all we can do is keep saying yes. So I think we're prepared to move the revised draft with these edits, but I don't want to get ahead of myself and miss an opportunity for another colleague to support that motion that may support it if he had another chance to weigh in.
I think he was talking about you, Commissioner Walther.
Yeah, that was my person. I think, like I say, I'm not prepared to vote for it. It came off the press so late last night. There was one phrase that got left out. I don't know if it's magic or not, but it was concerning me in the previous draft. I think it's tighter. Not prepared to vote yes now, though. We did talk about bifurcating it, so if we want to go with a consensus for yes on the first question number one, certainly that's fine with me. Question number two, but I think the economist from Wyatt didn't want it that way, so that's, I guess, the deal for him. Another question, I'd like to have a little more time. I'm not going to ask him for it. I mean, if you have to get a vote now, I know I told you, Mr. Rice, last time I went to look at it, and so I had made some proposals, but I want to have a little more luxury.
Mr. Vice Chairman?
What do you think? And so just once again, I think in a number of ways I like it, but I think that I was thinking of rephrasing the generally, I guess these two people, the positions they hold are there, and that's unalterable. That will also always be the case. That's in a little stiff in terms of gathering in your operation, but it seems like they're included or should include or whatever is more taking place in my principal day-to-day role. How much and what role is unclear. So I'm worried about the latitude that could be, inadvertently taken advantage of in the way that we don't want to leave this. So I think this has been, from my perspective, more acceptable document. But I welcome Mr. Lyons' comments on those three areas that I brought up just now. The board generally was in there for a reason. The limitation to executive director, chief operator is there for a specific reason. Nobody else can do it, just them. And the likely to go into the operations, what does that mean? What kind of role the operations, what does that mean in your mind?
Mr. Lice?
Well, I mean, look, I start with the basic proposition that there is nothing other than state law currently that prohibits a governor from consulting with the operation of, let's say, a federal super PAC. I mean, in some respects, I mean, candidly, with a lot of respect for commissioners who I respect enormously and an agency that I've spent my entire career appearing before, we are kind of getting ourselves wrapped around the axle here. The truth is, there is nothing that prevents a number of governors from talking to a super PAC who are doing federal election activity. Nothing. Nothing. Nothing in the regs, nothing in the book, nothing in the history, nothing. So the reason why we put that in there was it is a fact that under state law, it is going to be just as a matter of state law, as a general matter, that you're going to have circumstances in the same way that I would say generally federal candidates cannot consult with a super PAC. Doesn't mean they never can. I can give you hypotheticals where a federal candidate can consult with a super PAC. But if I were writing an advisory opinion in California or in Missouri, I'd say generally you're not going to have federal candidate involvement with the operations of a federal super PAC. Likewise, generally, it is the case that state laws are going to limit the ability of state candidates and office holders to be involved in this organization. But honestly, there is nothing in federal law that restricts that. Nothing. I didn't ask that question. I didn't ask the question because there isn't a question to be asked. So I think, to me, I came here asking an easy question and a hard question. The hard question is whether or not the Democratic Governors Association is the kind of association that McCain-Feingold sought to limit. To me, the easy question was jobs and opportunity. I mean, honestly, it's just not a hard question. We pointed to the fact that it was the Democratic commissioners in Flake. It was the Democratic commissioners in Flake who thought it was important to draw exactly the kind of line we are drawing here. Now, in that case, it was to limit the ability of federal candidates to raise soft money. It was to take a restrictive view of the campaign finance laws. But honestly, that same principle applies here, which is that Congress, to quote the Flake opinion, where Congress uses different terms, it must be presumed that it means different things. It simply meant different things in the section on national parties, federal office holders, and association of state candidates. So, I mean, it is obviously frustrating to have been here now for three sessions, and I feel like we're closer in some senses and not closer in other senses. But honestly, if there were another draft that people were going to vote for that I thought had a plausible view on jobs and opportunity, I'd be talking about that draft. I actually don't even know what the other vote is for, because the other draft doesn't make any. The other draft does not adhere to the precedent of the commission, nor the statutory text, nor the regulatory text. So, I mean, I think if the issue is we need another couple of days to sort of bring this to closure, obviously I'd rather walk out with four votes than not. But if what I'm hearing is that there are just sort of two different views on this, you know, I think I mentioned this last time, I'm pretty sure I know how this would work out in the enforcement context. These folks would never let you bring this case going any further. There may be a good policy reason why, if you were in Congress, you would have drafted the statute differently, but as an agency charged with just interpreting law as it's written, I think, you know, I'm pretty comfortable on the jobs and opportunity front. So I think if we can get to four votes, we ought to get to four votes. If we're a day away from four votes, I'll go back to my client and ask for a couple of days. But I don't think it's going to be, unless you tell me it's going to be productive for us to do this again in a couple of weeks. I feel like you've heard just about everything I have to say on this subject.
I hear you on that, Mr. Elias. I think that may be up to Commissioner Walther. It was my sense at the end of the last meeting that Commissioner Walther was a little bit closer to my Republican colleagues than I was, and I'm trying to interpret what I think I've been hearing over the phone. And I should mention, Commissioner Walther, that sometimes it's not crystal clear over the phone. So I don't know whether you need to put your mouth closer to the phone, or I don't know whether you're on a speakerphone. But we're not hearing you with crystalline perfection. So I just wanted you to know that. What do you think, Commissioner Walther? Do you think
is it coming clear now?
Yes, that's much better.
I'm really sorry about that. I wish you'd mentioned that earlier. It would have been very easily remedial.
So do you think that a couple of days would bring us to four votes or not?
Well, I really don't. I don't know at this point. After what I hear, I think maybe we're not. Those are the three areas we had concerns on, but they didn't get discussed. And I think maybe we're better off just voting now.
I couldn't hear the last bit. I apologize.
I think that there may be a little bit of confusion due to the earlier fuzziness of the transmission as to what the three areas are that you are concerned with. If you'll indulge us, Commissioner Walther.
Well, please let me know if it isn't coming clear. I really apologize for that. And I assume it's okay now?
Yeah. We hear you now.
And did they really colloquy when they were holding forth on the amendment? Was that heard?
Pretty much.
That was crystal.
Vice Chairman says crystal.
That part was clear.
Sorry about that. Well, really, I was looking at some guidance on those three areas where this is will generally not play a role. I hear Mr. Elias, but the Governor's Association can't do what this is intended to do, jobs and opportunity. So if it is doing what it's not supposed to do on its own, through jobs and opportunity, that's the gravamen of the, if we call it wrong, but the, for me it is not right. And you can call it agency, you can call it alter ego, you can call it an instrument of control, but that's really, I think, what I'm sure there's about, as am I. And so the statute isn't so much the overriding consideration. You have a structure where it says that the association's members will generally not play a role, but when just generally when it really matters, and what kind of role might it be? Those are some of the concerns that I still have. I don't know that we can get over that hump, but frankly. We did have put in there will generally be concluded by law, you know, state law. I thought that was a good way to give notice of the concern. But then we have likely to play a day-to-day role. That's concerning because if they likely do, they probably will be playing a day-to-day role, and it isn't clear exactly what that is. So I was looking for some guidance on it. I hear Mr. Elias and the frustration, and I suggest that we both give a segregated vote on one and two, and at least you'll know that there's an agreement on one, and then we'll probably deadlock on two.
And let me just say that as I heard Mr. Elias, I think perhaps he, again, maybe the transmission's not going through on the other side as clearly as it could also, but I heard him say that the generally was meant to be a generalization, given that, you know, we're not going to ask him to put a 50-state survey into the AO request of what the individual laws in each of the 50 states would dictate here. I don't know whether you want to speak to the day-to-day operations aspect that Commissioner Walther asked about.
Which is the line that
I think that would probably be on line 10 to 11. Page 5.
The while jobs and opportunities own members will be associate officers and other
association. Other association employees will play a role in the day-to-day operations. I think Commissioner Walther was asking for more clarification as to what kind of a what that day-to-day role would be. Am I reading you right, Commissioner Walther?
Well, there's a part that says will generally not play a role in decisions about jobs and opportunities, daily operations, or how it spends its funds.
Yeah, I think it's a different section,
oh, okay.
Commissioner.
Sorry.
Then there's a subsequent statement about association employees are likely to play a role in day-to-day operations of the organization. Questions that will...
Commissioner, what... I'm just trying to find the page and the line number.
Mr. Noti, do you have some...
I believe it's page 2, lines 14 through 16.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, I think it goes to the chair's point. What we say is to comply with state prohibitions on coordination. So it's gonna run the gamut. I mean, there's gonna be states that are very, very restrictive, where the generally no role will be absolutely no role. There will be other states that have coordination rules, not unlike the FEC's rules, which are absolute prohibitions in certain time periods around certain kinds of conduct, less absolute prohibitions in other times during other kinds of conduct. You know, we were not trying to sort of slip one by you. We were trying to, as I said, if I were sitting before the Minnesota or Michigan or Montana campaign finance board and I had to summarize something about federal elected officials and super PACs, I would say generally they don't play a role. Now, you know, there's a lot of water under the bridge of when they can and when they can't, but in general they won't because of the presence of coordination rules. And that's going to be true at the state level, short of sort of defining 50 states' coordination rules and what that is. It's going to be I'm open here to finding a way to bridge that. Do you want to delete it? We were actually just trying to give you a sense that there are coordination rules in the states, like there are at the federal level, and that that's going to have a practical effect to the extent that matters. Honestly, I'm not sure it's a legally dispositive fact whether they do play a role or not, because as I point out, I don't think there's a legal issue there, but I thought it would give you a little more flavor for them.
Well, again, the way it stands, it just is. There's no way to look in retrospect and say there is any limit put on it. That's all. That's a concern for me, as generally not play a role in jobs daily operation or how it spends its funds. But then, later on, it points out that they are likely to play a role in day-to-day operation. And so, I don't know. We can count it in or not, but I think, honestly, Mr. Lass, we may not be able to bridge a gap that's going to work. And I'm mostly concerned about the delay that it's been imposed on you, and I apologize for that.
Mr. Lass.
At the risk of overstaying my welcome, then, because I realize this is not really a question put by the commission, but
join the club.
As I heard things play out, I think that there was originally some question in some commissioner's mind whether or not I was correct on the main question, and that this was an effort to what I thought I heard Commissioner McGann say in his opening soliloquy when this was first being considered is basically maybe we say no on the hard question, but there is an easier question. Frankly, to the extent we're going back to the drawing board, I would urge the commission, frankly, to adopt draft C, which says yes on both, and in the alternative to draft A, not as amended, but as originally proposed. Because I feel like I have now, in some sense, given several times to try to get to a place of four votes, but if I'm not going to have four votes, frankly, I'd rather have three versus two on draft C or on original draft A.
What does that get you?
What does that get me? It gets me three. It gets me a lot. Yeah. Gets me that there are three votes. There are not four votes on the commission. There are two votes on the commission against my position. And last time I checked, it would mean that there would have to be two more commissioners to change their mind before the federal government could decide to enforce the statute. So I'd honestly, if we can't get to a consensus of four votes, I'd just as soon go back to where I think I started. But
okay, then. I just want to apologize. I thought this extra 2 weeks might get you those four votes.
In fairness, Commissioner, I appreciate the hard work of you and your staff and the hard work of Commissioner Walther and Vice Chair McGann and Commissioners Peterson and Hunter. All of you have tried, and the General Counsel's Office, you've all tried to work through this. It hasn't just been 2 weeks, however, though, just for the record.
It's been
now over the course of the entire summer.
I know, but we did. You know, the 2 weeks were extra. The 60 days, you know, is sort of normal course.
I appreciate it.
So I feel bad for that.
And I meant the part that I said. I appreciate that you all have struggled with this and have given it the attention you have. So that's all a requester in my position can ask.
Okie doke. Motions, Mr. Vice Chairman?
I move adoption of agenda document number 13-31, draft A.
Okay. The Vice Chairman has moved adoption of Draft A, Agenda Document 13-31. Any discussion on the motion? Commissioner Hunter?
I just want to apologize for bringing you back in here again. I mean, this is crazy. I can't. We just had the same conversation three times, and you've waited this long. People didn't work as hard as they could, and I apologize.
Any further discussion on the motion? Okay, I'll call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No.
No.
Motion fails 3-2 with the Vice Chairman, Commissioners Hunter and Peterson voting for, and Commissioner Walther and me voting against. Is there any interest in going question by question? Mr. Vice Chairman? Oh, you want a minute? Okay. Sure. Mr. Vice Chairman? No?
If someone wants to move question by question, we can entertain it. But I'm not sure what question, because we just voted for ours. So.
Okay.
Still not sure everybody else is, so we'll find out.
Got it. Commissioner Walther, in order that I think there is agreement on at least one of these answers, and we might as well do that. And I believe the answer, I'll look to counsel on this. I believe the answer to question one is the same in all the drafts. Am I correct about that?
No.
No, I'm not correct about that.
I believe draft A and B reach the same result on question one, but the wording is not identical, mm-hmm. and draft C reaches the opposite result.
Right, yes. That I knew that part. Okay. Well, I would be prepared to support the answer to question one in draft A. Commissioner Walther, are you interested in moving question one, the answer to question one in draft A?
I'd be glad to make that motion, but I understood that Mr. Lassen, I'm interested in that.
Well, whether he's interested in it or not, he asked two questions, and I think there's actually consensus on one of them.
I think if the requester doesn't want an answer, then it's a concern to me, but I'd like to hear on that.
I guess.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Sorry. Okay. It's sort of like Quasimodo in The Hunchback of Notre Dame. He yells sanctuary when you run into the church, and that maybe that withdraws the AO. And until the requester yells out withdraw, I think the question's on the table, and we answer the question. Right?
Yes, yeah. I would think so.
I don't know if there's a mechanism where, Mr. Lies waves a special flag or something. Maybe an upside down, like a distress flag, or maybe the Jolly Roger in your case. I don't know. But
we didn't stock the table with flags.
I'm not sure.
But there's no motion on the table now. And there is an opportunity to comment on that. The requester really has, the authority to decide whether or not the requester wants an answer on a question or wants to withdraw it, essentially. So I think that if I hear that the requester is not inclined to want to hear it, if it's only on question one, then we have to honor that.
Well, the requester wants a different answer on question one, but, sometimes requesters don't get the answers they want. I'm in an awkward position because I would like to be on record as supporting the answer to question one, but the chair does not generally make motions.
But is the question still before us?
I believe it is. He hasn't withdrawn it.
Well, if does everyone recognize that the opportunity to withdraw exists right now, so that I don't know if Mr. Lass is uncharacteristically silent on this point.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Maybe Commissioner Walther is indirectly asking the requester if they wish to withdraw, because Commissioner Walther, because if I could address the commissioner directly, Madam Chair.
Feel free.
Since you're not here, you're not seeing the body language, and I can describe it. Mr. Elias is just sitting there, and he's not waving or saying anything about withdrawal.
There's no flags.
He's just sitting there.
A little morose,
taking what
perhaps.
We're dishing out.
It's
and
like a box
look,
of chocolate. I don't know what I get until I bite
it. That's right. Just don't bite down hard.
I assumed it was something like that, but I gather if it's still before us and the motion needs to be made out of the courtesy, I'll be glad to make that motion on behalf of the chair. And if she does, and the vote comes up, then I'd support that. But we don't have to do that.
Okay, I will take that as Commissioner Walther moving approval of the answer to question one in draft A.
Original A.
And we'll authorize any technical conforming edits just in case. Any discussion on the motion? I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That motion carries 5-0. I don't.
We can wait for the sixth commissioner before we.
Well, you might get a better answer. Well, this happens sometimes. It's harder to get to four when you only have five to start with. I wouldn't support a motion to adopt the answer to question two, so I don't feel the need to ask for that motion to be made. I think it's.
I thought that was voted.
Already voted on that.
Yeah, we voted on it.
We're
so
fine.
I think, unless somebody else has anything else to say, Mr. Elias.
I just have a question. So the original vote was on original A. The second vote was on question one of original A.
Yes.
That's all I need.
Okay. I'm just rereading the answer one more time to make sure that I knew what I was voting on. I think
you can see that we snuck in there that, yeah, you know, and by the way, the answer to question two is yes. It's an invisible ink. It'll appear.
Just checking.
Once there's six commissioners, it'll appear on the page.
Just checking.
And that's what will be published.
It has been pointed out to me, and I don't know whether this would qualify as technical and conforming edits, that one of the additions in the later numbered or lettered drafts was to incorporate later information that we got from the requester. I assume...
I'll see why.
That, Mr. Vice Chairman...
The only concern is something Mr. Elias had said. He feels like he's given and given and given to try to get an answer, and he'd rather start where he started without getting into... So when we just incorporate by reference generally anything you've said here, that can be read as incorporating things that you've proffered for the sake of argument that are not really...
Right.
I meant his written comments, but...
Okay. I'm happy incorporating the written comments. The last one's perfect. I can incorporate by reference as my own words, actually. It's well stated. So, yeah, written comments are great.
All right.
I thought you meant the discussion of the facts at the table.
No.
Okay.
I just want to be clear, though, that the written comments include proposed language concessions that we were willing to make, and I honestly would ask the commission not to incorporate those by reference. Those are in writing, but that was an accommodation when I thought that there was, I think it's draft A as draft A.
Okay.
The public record will reflect what we have submitted in writing, but if...
It's fine. I'm comfortable with draft. The answer to question one in draft A as written.
Cool.
I think that we have exhausted every possible avenue on this, and I appreciate your patience, Mr. Elias.
And I appreciate the commission's. Thank you.
Do we need to instruct counsel to prepare a draft on the second question that we
yes.
can get four?
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. I think that in the normal course, counsel will then prepare an answer that answers question one and says that the commission couldn't find four votes to answer question two. And I don't think we need a vote for that. I think that's just the
consensus.
Normal course of action. Okay. Well, moving right along, we get to Draft Advisory Opinion 2013-12. Service Employees International Union and Service Employees International Union Committee on Political Education. And feel free, I suspect somebody may have a question, but by all means, come and see
the table. Mr. Schneider from the Service Employees Union and SEIU COBA. And unless there are questions, I'm happy to answer any questions. But I thought that Draft A all and
okay. Ms. Wallstriker, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Weintraub. Good morning, afternoon, Commissioners.
Yes. Sorry about that. It should be morning and yet it's...
Agenda document 13-38 is a draft response to an advisory opinion request submitted by SEIU and its SSF, the SEIU Committee on Public Education. Political Education, I'm sorry. SEIU COPE receives its contributions mostly through payroll deductions from members of its restricted class. Currently, members of the restricted class authorize these payroll deductions either in handwritten documents or by electronic signatures through email or web-based communications. The requesters ask whether payroll deduction authorizations may be obtained from members of the restricted class through recorded telephone conversations subject to certain safeguards. The draft concludes that the proposed method of obtaining and maintaining payroll deduction authorizations is consistent with the Acting Commission regulations because it incorporates sufficient procedural safeguards and record-keeping mechanisms. We did not receive any comments on the draft and on the request, and we received two comments on the draft. And if the Commission votes to approve the draft, we ask for authority to make any necessary technical and conforming changes. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Council, welcome.
Thank you.
A couple questions. One, I seem to be asking this of everyone who comes before us on AOs, but given that we don't have six commissioners, can we decide this AO? It seems like a very important AO to your client. Is it okay that we rule on this, even though we don't have
Yes.
It is. Okay.
We would prefer
it's
a ruling.
Fine. It's fine with the labor union. We can vote on this.
Yes.
Okay. Just want to make sure that we're clear. Two, a comment was filed, and it's well taken. It looks to the E&J of a rule from, I guess, 2005, and it talks about the checkoff needs to be in writing. It does say that. Now, let me give you kind of where I'm coming from, and I'll let you react to it so you're not guessing what's coming. It certainly says that. I have some concerns, though. First, when you pass a reg, you have to promulgate an explanation and justification, and as the name suggests, it explains and justifies the rule that was passed. And when I read this E&J, there's these couple paragraphs in here that seems to have nothing to do with the rule to which it's attached. It doesn't explain that reg. It doesn't justify that reg. It's this, oh, and by the way, you know, just as a matter of caution, you know. And so I think, well, how can that be? And I read it as the commission saying that that rulemaking didn't change that area of the law.
Yeah, that was
exactly, you left it alone.
It was my sense, yes.
So the question then is, what is actually the law? Is it actually in writing, or is that just a paraphrase the commission has used? And the issue then becomes, what is in writing? Well, when you read the E&J, you think it has to be a handwritten sort of thing that you would have back, you know, probably when the Act was passed, and that's one way to look at it. But on the other hand, when you read the advisory opinions and what the commission has done, it has certainly evolved away from that. And even at the time, around the time of the C&J, there were advisory opinions that took electronic signature and keypad and all sorts of other things. So what I'd like you to address is specifically the comment, and assist me with my thinking on this point, because the comment is quite persuasive. But the reality is the commission seems to have already gone down this road, and I don't think the E&J, a free-floating two paragraphs of, is there such thing as dicta in an E&J? I'm not sure that's the correct word for it, but it feels like it's language that I read is saying the commission's not touching that particular area of the law. When you read the AOs, it seems like what you're proposing is a lot like what the commission has gone for before, not quite, maybe a step beyond it. So first, comment on the comment, and either confirm or elaborate on my views. And two, if you could elaborate a little bit more, and you could simply read the request for me, and just to make sure we're clear on the facts about how this thing is memorialized, because I think there's a little confusion that, you know, someone's just calling on the phone and sort of taking notes, and it's going to be loosey-goose, and the records aren't maybe not going to be maintained, and there's going to be a possibility that people may be forced to check off, or the checkoff may occur without really the assent of the union member, and that's really the whole purpose of this rule, right? And there's been a lot of water under the bridge about checkoffs, and you know, some want an opt-in, some want an opt-out. It's an opt-in, and we have to make sure the opt-in is done by the book. A side note: the reg doesn't actually say in writing; it only appears in the E&J. I'll pick that up. But if you could maybe help me on this. On those two points, that would be much appreciated.
Sure. Thank you for the question. We agree with you about the E&J. I think it was just stating the current law. The commission has actually made a rule about record keeping in this area, and that rule has made clear that a written signed authorization is not required to be maintained. That's not exactly the same question as to what you have to maintain versus what you have to get in the first place, but it's very close. And it is of a piece with, as you said, all of the, I think it's three or four or five AOs in this area, which have stressed that under the law, no particular form of technology is required to constitute writing. I share your view that what we are asking is, if anything, is actually even a little less than the AO that was ruled on in the letter carriers case in 1999, in terms of keeping a telephone record.
Follow up on that. So really, this is just a variant of a theme that's already occurred.
It's been crossed.
This isn't a step beyond.
I think it's actually
the same sort of thing.
Yeah, and that one. it was all electronic. In other words, it was you could dial into a mechanical phone and hit buttons and register your PAC contribution. In this one, there's a live operator. This one has more protections than that one does, in fact, and that goes to your second question, so I'm happy to put on the record the kinds of protections we're talking about. I absolutely agree with you that, you know, opt-in, opt-out, all that's quite controversial. We're not in that world at all.
Policy choices we don't have to
right. This is an opt-in situation. We fully acknowledge that, accept that, think that's wise. This is about solicitations, when we, in fact, go out and seek someone. SEIU or SEIU COPE will be calling from a list of its members. So these are members. When it calls, it's going to say, we would like to record this phone call. And if the person is in a state where it takes two people to consent to that, we'll ask for consent. And if the person says, yes, I'll consent, we'll record the entire phone call. So there'll be no doubt about what happened. Once we've established that they are a member by asking their name, address, employer information, we'll make the request for a contribution. If the person agrees to contribute, it's recorded. And then there's a second level of recording. We'll have an electronic record of a kind the Commission has already previously approved for, say, Internet transactions. So you'll have a 3-year preserved phone record and a 3-year preserved computer record of the amount of contribution and that there was a voluntary opt-in to contribute. And in the phone call, we'll make clear, because this is an area that could be different, if you change your mind, if you want to amend, if you want to terminate, here's the number to call, here's the address to write. So it's got all of the protections that are listed in all of the AOs that have dealt with this. So I think of this as it's a little different than the letter carrier's case because there's a live operator and we are calling to the member as opposed to the member calling in. And so I thought it would be helpful to have an AO, but I think of this as breaking no new ground.
And just remind me of the letter carrier's case. People call. Can you flesh that a little bit?
Yeah. The letter carriers have retirees, and the retirees were arguably member retirees for purposes of being solicitable. The letter carriers put out a magazine to their retirees that say, hey, if you'd like to contribute to our PAC, here's the number you call. It was a little bit unusual in that magazine actually went to a broader list than actual retiree members. But the Commission nevertheless said, well, mostly goes to retiree members, so it's good enough for us at that point. And the member calls in, and it's all electronic, and says, do you want to give to the PAC? And yes, how much? Type in the amount. And they keep an electronic record. And the Commission said that was fine, unanimously. So.
And if that's a writing?
That's a writing.
This looks
they
a lot
said.
Like a writing,
yeah.
Too.
As a writing, yeah. I think, you know, the AO in 1999-3 in Microsoft is really quite thoughtful about this. It talks about contemporary technological innovations. It talks about that a particular form of technology is really not relevant to the either the substance or the actual literal language of the statute. And it at this point, the Commission has allowed emails, has allowed web-based clicks, and has allowed telephone records. And I think it's well within the rules that it has done so.
A lot of ways the horse has left the barn. I mean, the idea that the donor taking out a pencil and writing it down, that horse left the barn
a long time ago. Commission has long recognized that. And, you know, the fair concern raised in the comment is that there'd be some kind of verification that it really happened in all these cases. I think that's
We don't want somebody coming back and saying, gee, I didn't mean to, that's not what happened, you know, this was deceptive and that kind of thing. And it sounds like you've thought all that through.
Yeah, and sure, you know, and if they did, they can, you know, they're not stuck. They can say, oh, no, if that's what I did, I didn't mean to do it. Yeah, absolutely.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. After I received the comments from Holtzman Vogel, I myself, excuse me, went back and looked at the I took very seriously their argument, and I thought it was well-reasoned and thought out. I went back through the relevant rulemakings and advisory opinions to look at this with new eyes one more time, and I think I'm still where I was before, which is that I'm leaning to support the draft that has gone blue. And the reasons why, when I go back and, for example, look at the Microsoft PAC advisory opinion 1999-03. It doesn't look like the commission is getting into the metaphysical discussion of, is this an electronic signature a writing? It's looking much more at a kind of at a functional level. Does it have, does the system provide for a unique identifier? Are there sufficient safeguards to ensure the authenticity of the individual who's providing the authorization? Does it provide for the ability to revoke or modify one's ability to make that contribution? And is there an ability to maintain records through that system? And so I think it was really much more of a functional approach. And I would add that this whole written requirement with respect to providing affirmative authorizations in the payroll deduction context, it arose in an AO context. There's not some pre-existing regulatory norm that we would be deviating from. As the vice chairman pointed out, in an E&J, the kind of a restatement of what the AOs, there's kind of that boilerplate language that's tucked into all those prior AOs, was included, even though it was included in the ENJ for a rule that said nothing about this issue. So looking back at how the commission's treated this, it is much more of a functional approach. And I think that the approach that's taken in the advisory opinion draft that we have before us is consistent with how that's been laid out before. And just the final thing I would add is that while this is not a dispositive fact, it's somewhat relevant that in the litigation context, when discovery requests are submitted, that and the definition of document or writing, recordings of oral conversations fit within those definitions, and I think that's not an irrelevant fact to consider as we're considering this advisory opinion. But I'm also in the same place with the vice chairman, and I'm prepared to support the draft that's been made blue.
I am as well. I don't have any comments about it or questions. I'm prepared to support the draft. Commissioner Walther, did you have any comments on this one?
No, thanks for asking. I have none. I'll support the draft.
Okay. Mr. Vice Chairman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before I make the motion, I just want to state that even the AOs use the phrase in writing when it's not actually written.
Yes,
down.
I noticed that. Yes. Right.
Which is how I got comfort that the ENJ, when it says writing, you like to use plain language, but it means that we're defining writing to include things, well, in the way that federal courts recognize in discovery, right? That was really an excellent point that I hadn't thought of what Commissioner Peterson said. And yeah, when you get into discovery, more transcripts of oral conversations are writings of the, and they are considered writings. So that I don't see how we say no. Because it's just there's so much water under the bridge as to what's a writing. I mean, if the agency opened its doors and we were here 35 years ago and this was brand new, maybe we could say this isn't a writing, perhaps, maybe, but not now. On that, I would like to move agenda document number 13-38, which is the draft AO in this item.
Yes. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of Agenda Document 13-38, proposed answer in the Advisory Opinion 2013-12 to the Service Employees International Union, along with any technical and conforming edits, I assume.
Yes, that's an unstated part of my stated objection. Yes.
Yes, I knew that. Is there any discussion on the motion? I'll call the question. All in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries 5-0. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, staff, for your prompt and timely consideration.
Some people luck out that way. Okay. Next item on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2013-14 from Mr. Martin Long. Ms. Wallstriker, it's you again.
Thank you, Chair Weintraub. Agenda document 13-40 is a draft response to an advisory opinion request submitted by Martin Long. Mr. Long is a candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives from Massachusetts' 5th Congressional District in a special primary election to be held on October 15, 2013. Mr. Long has self-published a book on an issue that he describes as central to his campaign. He will receive royalties on any sales of the book and does not plan to donate the royalties to charity. He proposes to refer to the book in printed campaign materials that will be paid for and authorized by his principal campaign committee. He asks whether the proposed reference to the book on the campaign materials is consistent with the Act and Commission regulations. The draft concludes that the proposed reference to Mr. Long's book is consistent with the Act and Commission regulations because the portion of the campaign materials that will be devoted to the book and the additional cost to the campaign committee of including the reference to the book are de minimis. We did not receive any comments on the request or on the draft. If the commission votes to approve the draft, we ask for authority to make any necessary technical and conforming changes, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for counsel or comments on the draft? Mr. Vice Chairman.
The only comment is I can support the draft that's before us, agenda document number 13-40, which answers the questions in the affirmative.
Thank you. I am not going to be able to support the draft. I feel a little bad about the way this evolves, particularly with a 20-day AO. We have to get an answer out pretty quickly and get a draft out pretty quickly, and the requester chose not to appear, perhaps because he only saw one draft and might have drawn from that the conclusion that everybody was on the same page. But we have had several other advisory opinions on this topic. And I have generally not supported using campaign funds or materials prepared with campaign funds to promote a book where the candidate slash author is drawing royalties and making a profit off the book. There was the Granger AO in which Congresswoman actually wrote a children's book and did not purport to be using de minimis resources, but she also wasn't going to keep any of the royalties. She was going to donate them to charity, and that is a common path that a lot of members have taken when they've written books. The Hayward and the Scott Brown AOs took this approach of de minimis. As long as it was de minimis, it was the reference was okay. I did not support either of those AOs. This is one of those instances where it actually makes a difference sometimes not having a full slate of commissioners. Commissioner Lenhart supported the Hayward AO, and Commissioner Bowerly supported the Brown AO, and neither of them are here anymore. And I'm going to stick with my consistent position on this issue that it is a personal use. I spent a long time looking at these palm cards because I do think that this presents a closer call than any of the other ones that have been presented to the commission in the past. When I look at this to me does not actually even look like de minimis. It's fairly his reference to the book is fairly prominent on the palm cards, and. You don't look at both sides of the palm cards at the same time. You only look at one side at a time. If you look at this, the reference takes up, I would say, roughly 10% of the surface area, and to me, that's not de minimis. And indeed, even in the Scott Brown AO, the commission said that 10% of the Twitter feed, 10% of a Twitter page would be more than de minimis. So I don't think this meets the de minimis standard. Now, this does raise an interesting question because in some of these, not in all the iterations, but in some of these palm cards, he doesn't say
buy the book. He doesn't say read the book. He just says I wrote the book. And I don't mean to suggest that people have to scrub their backgrounds and their biographical information, and they have to pretend they didn't do what they did. I think that if it did meet what I would consider to be the de minimis standard, and all it said was wrote the book and named the book, I would probably be okay with that. I think that the I hear what the requester is saying when he says, well, I didn't say buy the book, I just said read the book. It's a self-published book. Maybe there will be copies in the library, but I think that it's likely that if somebody really wants to read this book, they are going to have to buy the book. And so I think that even read the book, it does consist of promoting the book and trying to get more people to buy the book. So, like I said, I think this is a much closer call. I think that the certainly if while he was using these campaign materials, he were to forego the profits and donate them to charity, that would solve the problem for me. But otherwise, I'm going to stick with my consistent position that it is generally not appropriate to use campaign resources to promote a book from which the author is actually keeping the royalties. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. But as a biographical thing, it's okay to say you wrote a book. Is there a way, maybe you don't want to do this, but is there a way he can rewrite it to, you know, instead of saying, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, for more on the issue, read the book. I respectfully disagree that that's really flagging for the book, because I don't know how else you say I got a book other than to say I got a book, and it seems weird to say I have a book, but not, I mean, he could mention the book. Just, is there a way he can do it that's not?
Well, as I said, I think that if it, I don't think this is a de minimis. To me, this is more than de minimis. If I thought it was de minimis, then the phrases in the where he says on the palm card wrote the book, I would that I think would not present a problem for me. As I said, if I thought it was de minimis, but I don't. I think this is more than de minimis.
I mean, what if he said these are the issues that matter, as I explained in my book? I mean, this is the stuff people go through when they're trying to get mail. I mean, it's you know, it's kind of, I mean, if you got rid of the picture of the book, I mean, it doesn't look like 10%. It looks like less than 10%, but I don't know. It's an R-type font. I'm just not sure how he can say he wrote a book without mentioning doing it this way. And I'm not sure there's another way to do it other than this way. And if he can't do it this way, then we're really saying he can't mention he wrote a book.
Well, as I said, I don't want to rewrite his palm card for him. I don't want to, you know, well, what if it was in this font, and what if it he said this instead of that? I think that's we're getting into the realm of hypotheticals. I just wanted to say that there are, even though I'm not going to support this draft, I'm not saying that there are no circumstances in which I would say it was appropriate for somebody to say, I wrote a book using campaign materials. Because, as I said, using the famed even eye test, I try to take a pretty hard line on what I see are personal use issues, but even I would not say that somebody's got to cross out lines off their biographical information and pretend they didn't do something that they actually did do. So I wouldn't go that far. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Related to that, question two... which is a reference to the book on any other printed materials distributed by the committee consistent with the Act and Commission regulations. And the answer in the draft is we don't have enough facts, which is true. I mean, the answer to the question on its face on the one hand is yes, right, is a reference to the book, I guess. But without seeing the piece, yeah. It's tough to say. But I want to just state in case the requester may be hopefully listening in, it's really the same issue. Yes, you can reference the book. It's how you do it. And I think once the votes are counted, you'll have three commissioners saying you can reference the book even the way you want to reference it in your palm card. And, you know, biographical references are certainly okay, but there won't be four votes, I take it, for at least question one is presented. But I want to flesh out question two. I want to answer it. I would need to see the piece to know, but it certainly is something that generally is okay so long as it doesn't turn into
personal use. Can't have campaign money for, you know, to pay for your book tour, that sort of thing. But the difference between the two extremes, well, we can't do that today, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I agree with you that there's not enough there in the second question to be able to answer it, although I think there are some hypothetical circumstances in which I could answer that question. Yes, it would be too hypothetical. Commissioner Walther, did you want to say anything on this one?
I agree with you. The only close call for me was the second, I guess it'd be pages 3 and 4, where he just says wrote the book. The minimum issue is close, and some of our history, but it meant that just looking at Webster on the minimus, it says, lacking significance or importance so minor as to merit disregard. I don't think it was meant that this should be disregarded in any respect. And we've gone through various ways, whether it's by space or maybe size of print or maybe with location. I think this is certainly the borderline. But I think if you just said wrote the book, honestly, I really think some of that really say they wrote a book. And the vice chair said, we shouldn't preclude people from putting on the resume what they've done in an objective way. It says about his findings, conclusions, and winning strategies for change. That gets a little bit in the sales category for me. So I'm on the fence, but my right, I guess, I'll join you in saying no on all three, but second one is definitely on the fence. Definitely on the fence.
I'm sorry, were you finished?
The author, the question is not here, right?
No.
I'd like to move adoption of agenda document number 13-40.
The Vice Chairman has moved adoption of Agenda Document 13-40, a proposed answer to Draft Advisory Opinion Request 2013-14 from Martin Long, and authorize any technical and conforming amendments that may be necessary. Any discussion on the motion? I'll call the question. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? No.
No.
Motion fails 3-2. With our apologies to Mr. Long, I think we will have to direct counsel to issue the standard, there were not 4 votes to approve an answer letter. Mr. Staff Director, any management or administrative matters?
Madam Chair, there are no such matters.
This meeting is adjourned.